So yeah, I think we'll get started with the talk now. Wait for other people to show up while Tom is speaking. So Tom is going to be presenting the talk on Has There Ever Been a Just War Today? Tom's actually an activist from Adelaide and has journeyed over to Melbourne to be part of the Marxism Conference. If you have thoughts and opinions and questions perhaps that are provoked by the talk, just make a note of them. Because we will be leaving discussion to the end, and feel free to raise it at that point, stick around as well for the end at the end for a few announcements. But that's kind of it. So welcome, Tom.
Cool. There have been few world leaders who have been so open about the role in war of the profit-making and self-interest of the powerful as Donald Trump. So since the withdrawal of US troops, he has made it one of his most common talking points that the United States should have taken more of Iraq's oil during the invasion. Maybe you'll have another chance, he told the CIA on his first full day in office. Trump's remarks at the time were greeted with shock. Illegal and impossible were the consensus in the foreign policy mainstream. As Trump's former national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, put it, "We can't do this and you shouldn't talk about it, because talking about it is just bad. It's bad for America's reputation, it will spook allies, it scares everybody." So bad for America's reputation. Much better, of course, to talk about the threats of weapons of mass destruction and genocide, or of the need to end a dictatorship and fight for democracy. Our rulers do not care about overriding the opinions of the majority. But when wars require large mobilisations of people and resources, it's important to have a story that wins more support than sacrifice your life for the interests of the rich. And there are several playbooks. Nationalism is key, often alongside racist hatred of the so-called enemy. Hyped-up scare campaigns about communism and terrorism have both played their roles. But in recent decades, with the end of the Cold War, one of the most commonly told stories for defending the war efforts of the West is that of the humanitarian intervention. These wars are meant to help more lives than they hurt. It is argued that they're not waged on behalf of the countries fighting them, but on behalf of a people facing genocide. Interventions into Kosovo, Afghanistan, Libya, and Timor-Leste are prominent examples. I'm going to argue that these wars have nothing to do with humanitarianism, and that a look at the history of how these wars have actually played out shows the imperial ambitions which in reality drove them. And yet accompanying every new war is the assurance by humanitarian backers that this one is different. It's more urgent, less cynical, and that opposition would just be dogmatic, knee-jerk anti-imperialism. I don't think the concept of a humanitarian intervention is bad, though, just in its application. It's the whole logic which is the problem. So after examining a few of these, you know, actually existing humanitarian wars, I'm going to look at the intellectual framework, just war theory, which is used to underpin these humanitarian arguments. And then I'm going to outline an alternative framework for evaluating the justice or otherwise of wars. This framework will let us examine some of the other candidates for just war, like civil wars, World War II, national liberation struggles, and help us come to a well-rounded answer to the question of this talk, has there ever been a just war? But first, humanitarian war. There is hardly a limit to the horrors that imperialist powers will label humanitarian, and I think you just need one word for that, Iraq. Millions of lives destroyed, sectarian bloodshed continuing to this day, a well-documented campaign of lies and deception about weapons of mass destruction, a completely fabricated story of Iraqi connections to the September 11 attacks. There are a few wars that are so widely considered unjust. Even before it began, millions had taken to the streets rejecting it, with the largest simultaneous protests in history taking place globally in the month prior to the invasion's launch. As the war began, it quickly became obvious that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and the scale of violence and destruction caused by the invasion reached mammoth proportions, over 1 million dead, not to mention the other crimes of the occupation, like the torture of prisoners in Abu Ghraib. And yet, at the time, there were gallons of ink poured into defending the humanitarian motivations of Bush and Cheney in their drive towards war. So Iraqi-British academic Kanan Makia claimed Iraqis would greet the invasion with sweets and flowers. And Christopher Hitchens speculated that a massive landing will bring food, medicine and laptop computers to a surging crowd of thankful and relieved Iraqis and Kurds. And Tony Blair himself tried to justify the war in humanitarian terms, So in a 2004 speech, he said, "We surely have a responsibility to act when a nation's people are subjected to a regime such as Saddam's." And as later became clear, that responsibility to act apparently means lying about intelligence reports in order to whip up support for what has been one of the most brutal crimes of the 21st century thus far. Within a couple of years, most of these liberal apologists had recanted their support of the widely hated war. But not every war is like Iraq. Some today are still seen to more credibly have had a humanitarian purpose or a just cause. In the 1990s, it was the US-NATO intervention into Kosovo against Serbia that established the classic model of humanitarian intervention. So while the various interventions into the Middle East have largely been discredited, this war is still very often seen as different and still gets referred to as a model of just war. The horrors it supposedly prevented are meant to show that there is a positive role for US bombers. And so, as Bill Clinton said, "NATO stopped deliberate systematic effects at ethnic cleansing and genocide," or so it said. But far from being a solution to ethnic cleansing, intervention strengthened it. 2,000 people had been killed in the war prior to NATO intervention, about half by Serbian forces. It was only after the NATO bombing campaign began that on-the-ground atrocities by Serbian forces increased, with around 10,000 deaths. There was a wave of nationalist violence fueled by the US intervention. So plenty of Serbian workers hated the ruling Milosevic dictatorship. The years prior to and following the war saw mass protests and workers' occupations that actually eventually led to the overthrow of the regime. But as much as they might have hated Milosevic, they were also not going to allow the US to impose a regime on them. Milosevic was able to position himself as an opponent of foreign aggression, and with the Kosovar leadership supporting intervention, it was easier for Milosevic to divide the Serbian working class whose neighbourhoods were being bombed from the mass of oppressed Kosovans. Thus, the impact of the NATO intervention was to aid the worst sectarian elements in former Yugoslavia. The violent air campaign appears not as a solution, but as a cause of the crisis. The bombing itself killed at least 500 civilians. NATO suffered no casualties. So, from a humanitarian point of view, the intervention was a disaster. There were 45,000 refugees prior to the war and 800,000 afterwards. Less than 10% of the intervention's budget went to these refugees. But the intervention wasn't so disastrous for US interests. While homeless refugees fled into Europe, the Camp Bondsteel military base completed construction. 7,000 US soldiers remain there today, the largest US base in the Balkans. I think it's understandable that ordinary people can pin some hope on peacekeeping missions and the like. The horrors definitely are real. The only forces that appear to be able to do anything are imperialist powers. Something must be done, maybe said cynically by politicians, generals, and journalists, but I think it can express a genuine desire for a less horrible world by people shocked by the images of slaughter that they see each night on their TV screens. But what has to be done, and by whom? Getting rid of dictators? The US does indeed get rid of particular dictators by replacing them with US-backed governments, if not direct military occupation. Other loyal dictators it leaves in place, regardless of the horrors committed. Look at the US backing for the Saudi war in Yemen. But even when the US does step in, it just establishes another oppression, this time from an enemy with an incomparably bloodier history and larger number of guns. The idea that the oppressors in the West will be the liberators in the rest of the world is yet another restatement of the idea of the white man's burden. And the heroic struggles taking place in Algeria and Sudan are yet another refutation of the racist and condescending idea that Western armies are needed to overthrow dictatorships. So when people ask what we can do, we have to be really clear that the answer cannot be an imperial power. What we can do is build a struggle here in the West which can limit the evil our imperial rulers commit in the world and lend confidence to others struggling against their local oppressors. It is important to understand that these wars are all fought for imperialist interests and not for anything to do with humanitarianism. But one thing that I think can make that unclear is a confused understanding of imperialism, so I think it's important that we have a clear understanding of that too. We can't just reduce imperialism to direct plunder or taking the oil, as Donald Trump put it. A view like this can have trouble explaining why the US, for example, would spend $1.07 trillion in its war in Afghanistan, which is way more than it's ever going to get back in profits. It is true, of course, that control over oil and resources is crucial. But imperialism isn't just about direct profits. It's about competition. Capitalist companies don't operate in isolation. From banks to supermarkets, they compete with each other for market share. Between enterprises, this competition usually takes the form of price wars rather than shooting wars. But as capitalism develops, this global competition is fought over establishing access to or excluding rivals from entire national markets. Success here requires the threat or the use of military force. In this contest of control, what matters isn't just the sum total of wealth, but victory over one's rivals. In total wars, like the two world wars, this can mean retooling the entirety of the economy towards victory. For the victor, the costs of ensuring victory are worth it to ensure their continuing control and influence over markets and resources for decades to come. So just think at the end of World War II. As it came to a close, the victorious allies drew up spheres of influence that would remain basically intact for almost half a century. So when we're looking at a military intervention, whether it's Vietnam, Iraq, or Afghanistan, we can't just look at direct profiteering, although this obviously also plays its role. The US expense in these cases does outweigh its direct return. So instead, we have to look at the role of these interventions in excluding rivals and spreading global influence. And then it makes more sense why the US is willing to spend so much on the military. And it's imperial concerns that have shaped the concept of the humanitarian intervention in the post-Cold War era. If you read through the explicit foreign policy doctrines of every president, from Truman, just after World War II, through to Ronald Reagan, they're basically all about countering Soviet influence or halting the spread of international communism. And this makes sense. This reflected ideologically the splitting of the world into two great blocs around the USA and the USSR, which competed over global influence. But with the collapse of the USSR, the US obviously needed new ideologies. It was left in a clear position of global dominance, but it needed to find new ways to express and continue this dominance, to remind other international or regional powers, both large or small, that it wasn't to be challenged. And while it was and still is the world's largest economy, it is militarily that the US is far and away the most powerful nation. It still today accounts for around 50% of global military spending. But being a military power requires exercising that military, and this needs to take place without the justification of containing Soviet expansion. Humanitarianism provided the perfect solution. I think it's President Bill Clinton who quite clearly expressed this intervention in this doctrine in the 1990s, so I'm going to quote him. "Genocide is, in and of itself, a national interest where we should act," he said. "And we can say to the people of the world, whether you live in Africa or Central Europe or any other place, if somebody comes after innocent civilians and tries to kill them en masse because of their race, their ethnic background or their religion, and it's within our power to stop it, we will stop it." Now, this is clearly contradicted by the actual history of the US and its allies happily committing genocide in Iraq, Yemen, Palestine, you could go on. But when it does decide to, by identifying the usage of the US military with the universal interests of humanity, the US has a justification for the potential deployment of its military force almost anywhere on the planet. And so it uses these interventions, like in Afghanistan and Iraq, as a chance to assert itself in West Asia and the Middle East, just as it used Kosovo to establish a stronger presence in Central Europe. Or, to quote Bill Clinton again, "If we're going to have a strong economic relationship that includes our ability to sell around the world, Europe has got to be key. That's what this Kosovo thing is all about." So, as well as the direct gains that the US gets from each of these interventions, there's also the establishment of an infrastructure to intervene anywhere and anytime. So, for instance, US intervention into Kosovo, done without the backing of the United Nations, helped demonstrate that NATO could act on its own, and that allowed the US later on to sidestep Chinese and Russian vetoes on the Security Council. So it would go on to sidestep the UN Security Council again in its invasion of Iraq. The idea that the forces for imperialism could ever serve the interests of humanity, I think, also helps rehabilitate them for future wars. So anti-war movements and the defeat of the US and Australia forces in Vietnam left a massive albatross around the necks of these imperialist powers. And so for decades afterwards, they call it the Vietnam Syndrome, these countries were far less confident to engage in full-scale interventions. So, although invasions in wars, never ceased. There was clearly a limitation on how much they were able to deploy, you know, large numbers of troops or ground troops. But in the 90s and 2000s, the apparently humanitarian interventions these countries engaged in started to rehabilitate the idea of deploying military force. In Australia's case, it was the 1999 intervention in Timor-Leste, which I think most clearly played this role. Once again, this was a war that was justified as a humanitarian response to Indonesian suppression of the pro-independence movement. And the call for sending in the Australian military got the widespread support of most of the broad left at the time, including the unions, the Labour left, the Greens, and even many socialists. And I think one thing that confused the issue is the decades of opposition the Australian government had to Timor-Leste's independence, first under Portuguese colonial rule and then from 1975 under the domination of Indonesia. And so this enabled Australia to cut dirty deals. This opposition to Timor-Leste's independence allowed Australia to cut dirty deals with Indonesia to get access to the oil and gas in the Timor Sea. But after the overthrow of the Suharto dictatorship in Indonesia in May 1998, the collapse of Indonesia's occupation of Timor-Leste began to seem more and more inevitable. So Australia was happy to change approach to secure its wider project of regional domination. Unable to prevent independence, Australia acted to ensure it took place on their terms, deploying 5,500 soldiers and establishing its continued control over oil and gas in the region to this day. But beyond the impact on Timor-Leste, there was the rehabilitation of the Australian army. In the lead-up to the invasion, this was clearly recognised by the Australian Financial Review, which wrote, "This call to arms has, for the first time in decades, given broad legitimacy to the proposition that Australia should be able to intervene militarily outside its territory. This raises the possibility of building a domestic consensus, not just in favour of increased defence spending, but of changing the structure of the defence forces." And the following years did, indeed, see both expanded military spending and the increased deployment of Australian soldiers in the region, often justified directly using the example of Timor-Leste. So, for example, in announcing a massive increase in Australian military spending at the launch of the 2000 Defence White Paper, John Howard commented on, and I quote, "the heightened public interest in the military in the wake of the East Timor deployment and the natural pride that Australians felt in the professionalism and success of that operation." Now, many of those left-wingers who demanded Australian intervention into Timor-Leste saw themselves as trying to push the Australian army to take a progressive stand in support of a national liberation struggle. But popular pressure can't transform an imperialist army into a progressive one. Protests demanding intervention didn't push Australian imperialism to the left. Instead, they simply gave it left cover. I think that gets to the heart of the problem with the entire framework of just war theory. Just war theory is the main way that the ethics of war comes up in an academic context. If you ever study the ethics of war at university, you've probably looked at it. It attempts to provide a moral criteria for war, and that sometimes states can have a moral justification for resorting to armed forces. War is sometimes, but not always, morally right in order to prevent or oppose greater evils. So advocates of this position today can cite a long history of precedents running from Aristotle through Christian philosophers like Augustine and Thomas Aquinas to 17th century Dutch philosopher Hugo Grotius, who's credited with providing the intellectual frameworks of modern international law. Over the 19th and 20th century, just war theory was increasingly codified in international agreements and treaties such as the United Nations Charter and the Hague and Geneva Conventions. It became popular in the academy again during the 1970s in response largely to the Vietnam War. So the major work which revitalised this tradition and which you might still study at university is Just and Unjust Wars, A Moral Argument with Historical Illustrations, which is by Michael Walzer and was published in 1977. So Walzer was an opponent of the Vietnam War. And he didn't just think it was a strategic blunder. He, alongside most of the rest of the anti-war movement, thought it was morally wrong, that it was an unjust war. At the same time, though, Walzer was an opponent of both pacifism and anti-imperialism, He thought both of these were simplistic. So, in a later essay, he writes, "This is a radicalism of people who do not expect to exercise or use force, and who are not prepared to make the judgments that this exercise and use require. By contrast, just war theory, even when it demands a strong critique of particular acts of war, is the doctrine of people who do expect to exercise power and use force." So Volta quite explicitly sees himself here as a hand servant to power. In his view, this enables him to exercise a positive influence on the armed forces that more radical thinkers are cut off from being able to do. But in practice, he and other just war theorists end up providing a new language for describing and justifying the worst acts of imperialism. So, for instance, the explicit description of humanitarian intervention, a description of a humanitarian intervention, was formulated by just war theorists decades before it ever became more commonly deployed in mainstream political discussions. And Volta himself is aware of this problem. He describes the origins of just war theory in medieval Catholic thought, and he writes that, I quote, "The rulers of this world embraced the theory and did not fight a single war without describing it or hiring intellectuals to describe it as a war for peace and justice." And he notes how, actually, George H.W. Bush used the language of just war in justifying the first Gulf War, which Volta also opposed. And Volta himself has played an appalling role in defending Israel's wars over the decades. I think the problem here is not just one or another particular application of just war theory, however. It's a fundamental problem of assuming the moral legitimacy of an imperialist state to intervene in any way. In this, just war theorists are joining a long line of liberal supporters of empire. There have always been such theorists available to defend a positive role for structures of ruling class domination and oppression. As the utilitarian John Stuart Mill put it in his famous essay on liberty, despotism is a legitimate mode of government in dealing with barbarians, provided the end be their improvements. As socialists, we are fundamentally opposed to oppression. For us, any war which entrenches and strengthens the dominance of imperialism and capitalism, both over oppressed peoples and over the minds of those in oppressor nations, is unjust and must be resisted. And this includes all imperialist war. There is no just form of imperialism. I think the only way a war could be considered just is if it genuinely challenges oppression. So, in a long past era, things like the French Revolutionary War and the US Civil Wars were supportable in smashing up European feudalism and the Southern Confederacy of plantation slavery. This didn't mean that the bourgeois republics of France or the United States didn't have their own problems. Of course they did. They were capitalist, after all. But their victories were victories against even more reactionary forms of oppression. And I think today, socialists would obviously support a nascent workers' state defending itself against invasion from foreign imperialism and domestic reaction, as occurred after the Russian Revolution, for instance. Socialists, I think, have also supported, correctly, civil wars against dictatorships and fascism, seeing them as part of a class war to defend the rights of workers and their organisations within capitalist society, and ultimately as having the potential to turn into a full-blooded struggle against capitalism. So in 1917, again, for instance, when General Kornilov, a general from the Tsarist regime, launched a right-wing coup to crush both the Russian Soviets and Kerensky's bourgeois provisional government, the Bolsheviks fought to defend the provisional government from military dictatorship, seeing this as the only way to defend and strengthen working-class power in the Soviets or workers' councils. And in the 1930s, revolutionaries fought as part of the war against General Franco's fascist forces in Spain. So in fighting against this reaction, revolutionaries never forget the oppressive role of bourgeois governments and the need to overthrow them. In fact, I think we need to connect the necessity of deepening the struggle against all oppression to the defeat of particular fascist and reactionary forces. So in discussing the struggle against General Kornilov, the Russian revolutionary Lenin put it thus: "We are fighting against Kornilov, just as Kerensky's troops do, but we do not support Kerensky. On the contrary, we expose his weaknesses. We are changing the form of our struggle against Kerensky. Without in the least relaxing our hostility towards him, without taking back a single word said against him, without renouncing the task of overthrowing him, we say that we must take into account the present situation. And I think this approach was demonstrated in the positive in 1917, where the role of the Bolsheviks and the Soviets in defeating Kornilov later laid the basis for a successful workers' revolution in October, which overthrew the provisional government and established Soviet rule. On the other hand, in the 1930s war in Spain, where the workers' revolution was destroyed by the Republican government, the basis was laid for a fascist victory over the demoralised mass of workers and peasants. Socialists also support the rights of nations to fight for self-determination, insofar as such struggles can weaken imperialism and help to undercut imperialist sentiment in the minds of the working class of the oppressor nation. So we support, for instance, the rights of the Palestinians to resist their oppression by Israel and its imperialist backers, just as we supported the Vietnamese resistance to US and Australian invasion. Just as a capitalist state can entrench its rule and support through allegedly humanitarian interventions, the victory of national liberation struggles can actually play a crucial role in undermining and challenging this rule. Defeats for imperialism abroad weaken the state at home and can send a shudder throughout the entire global system of imperialist domination and oppression. So these struggles, although they're fought for national liberation and not for socialism, are therefore part of a globally progressive fight, and we should support them. What about the Allied war effort in World War II, which is often held up as the epitome of a just war? Well, I think for the rulers of Britain, the USA and the USSR, this was clearly a war for imperial domination. They had no support for democracy or humanitarianism. The 400 million Indians denied national freedom and democratic rights by the British Empire outnumbered those who were under the dominion of the Third Reich, and Winston Churchill's wartime policies led directly to the death of between 2.1 and 3 million people in the 1943 Bengal famine. These states also had no opposition to racism. Roosevelt was infamously responsible for the forced relocation and incarceration of 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry in the United States, and continued to rule over Jim Crow states in the south of the United States. And these states had no principled opposition to fascism. Churchill, prior to the war, had declared his admiration for Mussolini, and Stalin was quite happy to sign a pact with Hitler, and the Allies were also happy to support local fascist forces rather than let the left-wing resistance take power in Greece as the war concluded. As the war ended, the victorious powers carved out imperial spheres of influence and gave themselves permanent seats on the UN Security Council. And today, they still use the mythology of the war to bolster support for further imperialist aggression. So in justifying the invasion of Iraq, for instance, Saddam Hussein was referred to by George Bush as a new Hitler. At the same time as socialists shouldn't take sides in imperial conflict, it obviously was supportable to take up resistance against fascist dictatorship and invasion. So I think we have to evaluate that differently. The anti-fascist struggles of the French, Italian, Greek and Yugoslavian resistance movements, or the Warsaw Uprising, for example, should obviously be judged in a different way to the war efforts of imperialist powers. And I think we should support them, even if in cases we disagree with the politics that ended up leading these resistance movements. So I think, we should evaluate those differently to the imperialist war being fought by US, USSR and the Allies. But to return again, I think, to that question in the talk about has there been a just war? Clearly, as I've just gone through in the last little bit, we shouldn't take an abstract approach to the question. The violence of oppressors and of the oppressed are obviously not the same. And wars can be just insofar as they are about a fight against oppression. But I think in looking at this question, we also should not miss the woods for the trees. Most wars are not just, and the pressure to support unjust imperialist wars is enormous. The left has gotten it wrong several times. From social democratic support for colonialism 100 years ago and since, and during the First World War, social democratic support, right up to recently Noam Chomsky's support for continuing US occupation in Syria to protect Kurdish independence in certain areas. Time and time again, there's this temptation to see some sort of positive role for the capitalist state and for the imperialist armies. The question is a crucial one as well for the left to get right. We live in an increasing era of arms races and imperial tensions. Nuclear war is back on the agenda as a serious topic of discussion. Trump continues his bellicose threats. The politics of imposing imperialist war are crucial, and by no means are they the default. is one of the questions, for instance, that I think we can see that someone like Bernie Sanders is worst on. And I think it's really necessary that we deepen our understanding of the histories of capitalist wars and of the history of resistance to those wars in order to continue to argue against these pro-imperialist currents now and into the future. So to finish off, I'd like to finish up with a quote from US socialist Eugene Debs, who was someone who was imprisoned for his opposition to the First World War, someone who did take, you know, an excellent position on his opposition to imperialism. And I think it sums up my answer to the question of if there has ever been a just war. I am not a capitalist soldier. I am a proletarian revolutionist. I do not belong to the regular army of the plutocracy, but to the irregular army of the people. I refuse to obey any command to fight from the ruling class. I am opposed to every war but one. I am for that war with heart and soul, and that is the worldwide war of the social revolution. In that war, I am prepared to fight in any way the ruling class may make necessary. I'll leave it there. Thanks.